So I'm going to tell you about a project that we did at Microsoft over the past couple of years. We set out to do something that should sound very familiar to you, which is to build a high-performance, fault-tolerant data store out of commodity parts. And we wanted to do it for the same reason that everybody else wanted to do exactly the same project, which is that it's cheaper that way. And at the beginning of our project, we assumed that we were going to reach a conclusion that was pretty similar to what other people did when they did similar projects, which is to say, we would explore the space of possible replication algorithms, we'd choose a set of compromises that would be necessary in order to get performance, and then we'd find a way to live with the compromises that we did. But we entered the project with an open mind, and we did what seemed like a pretty thorough investigation of the alternatives and came to what was, at least to me, a pretty surprising conclusion, which is that, at least for this problem, there was no reason to compromise around any of the dimensions that the other systems had compromised in. And in fact, you could get really wonderful performance simply by doing a good job of building a Paxos replicated state machine. So Paxos replicated state machines are well-known objects, and I'll explain to you in a little bit how they work. But they have great properties, right? They're sequentially consistent, they tolerate all kinds of faults, they have nice theoretical properties, but everybody believes that they're just dog slow. This is not true, but that's at least the conventional wisdom. So the kinds of compromises that you'll see in the other systems to achieve performance, or supposedly to achieve performance, is you'll see things like compromising on consistency semantics. So if you read the GFS paper, you'll see that if machines crash, then they're eventually consistent. You know, maybe a write will show up, maybe it'll show up later. Dave is giving me a strange look. This is true. Or you'll find primary backup systems that use clock sync for correctness, which is something that you may be perfectly willing to do, but it's not a desirable property. It's a compromise that you would make. And that's actually the main thing I'm going to compare this against, but you could compare it against any of these other systems too. Or you'll see append-only systems, because it's actually a lot easier to get append-only replication to work correctly. Or you'll see systems that rely on special hardware, like FAB has NVRAM for logging write counters so that it can proceed. So if you're able to build a system that doesn't make any of these compromises and produce simply equal performance to the other systems, then that's a win, right? Because you've now moved the bar up. But as it turns out, on interesting loads, and in particular on a SQL Server load that I'll show you at the end, we actually get better performance than systems that made compromises supposedly to get more performance. So this should seem like a surprising result to you, because it certainly was to me. So if you get nothing else from this talk, the takeaway point that you should get is that when you're looking at systems that are worried about consistency and availability but not partition tolerance, right? There's the CAP theorem that says you can't have all three. So if you're not looking to build a system like CODA or Dynamo that's gonna run even when the network mostly goes away, and systems that have operation latencies that are comparable to, or in our case much bigger than the network latencies that you run on, meaning that probably this isn't great to run over the wide area network, Paxos replicated state machines are an option that you should explore, because you probably can get everything that you need from them. And now I'll tell you how. So now that we're 5 minutes into the talk, I'll give you the outline. I'm going to spend the first section describing exactly what replicated state machines are and enough of how Paxos works to understand the performance implications of it. Most of Paxos is well beyond the scope of the talk. I'm then going to proceed to tell you about SMARTR, which is our general Paxos state machine replication framework, and Gaios, which is a system that we built out of SMARTR in order to provide a virtual disk service. The word Gaios, it's named after the capital city on the Greek island of Paxos, because it was just too cute to resist. I'll then spend a while telling you about a new protocol that we came up with to allow you to efficiently do read-only operations, and its flexibility in this protocol that actually allows us to outperform the least-based protocols. I'll show you how that works. I'll do a performance evaluation with a fairly quick trip through it here, with just showing you one micro benchmark and then the OLTP benchmark. There's a lot more in the paper. So what's a replicated state machine? Say you've got some stateful computation and you want to make it fault tolerant. A way to do that is you take whatever the initial state is, empty or whatever, you make copies of that, and then to each copy you feed the same set of operations in the same order. As long as your computation is deterministic, each of those copies are going to proceed through the same sequence of states. Now, not necessarily in lockstep, but they'll proceed through the same sequence of states. So then if you lose any of the replicas, as long as you've got one left, you're okay. So that's a really nice property to have, But the tricky part of that is making sure that all of them see inputs in the same sequence. And Paxos is responsible for doing that. So Paxos is a protocol that, given a set of clients, there are multiple clients, they're sending requests into the system, even when all kinds of bad things happen, with, you know, the networks failing, machines failing right and left, machines rebooting, without making assumptions about clock, it'll serialize those inputs to the state machine. So combining Paxos with a replicated state machine will give you fault tolerance. The one thing that Paxos doesn't deal with is Byzantine faults. It turns out that our system actually deals with a limited set of Byzantine faults, but you have to read the paper for it because that's the last I'm going to mention it. So when you hear that description and you're thinking about building a disk-based system, you probably think, well, there's something really wrong here, because fundamentally what a state machine does is it takes one operation, it does the operation, and then it moves on to the next one. But if you think about how to make a disk efficient, disks really, really want to have a whole bunch of outstanding requests and reorder them dynamically. Think it's trying to run the elevator algorithm that y'all learned when you took operating systems. It's trying to reduce the seek distance. So there's a tension here. And you might think that the tension is going to cause you to get really bad performance. And in fact, if you did a naive implementation, it probably would. But there's an analogy that I like to draw, which is if you think about an out-of-order processor, to the assembly language programmer, it executes one instruction, then it executes the next instruction, and you can reason about it at that level. But if you look at what's going on inside the processor, before the instruction executes, it's got parallel instruction decode, it's got cache prefetching, it's got register coloring and allocation, it's got ALU allocation, all kinds of stuff that goes on to get it ready to retire that instruction in order, retires the instruction in order, and then afterwards, it's going to go back and it's going to write dirty cache lines out to memory. So it expresses parallelism both before and after the sequential step. We did essentially the same thing with replicated state machines, only, of course, many orders of magnitude slower than a processor, because we're talking about disks here. So Paxos is essentially responsible for taking requests that come in and binding those slots, 1, 2, 3, 4. Because one of the properties that we want to have in this system is that if the power goes off, results that you've acknowledged back to clients aren't lost, it's necessary to do a write to persistent storage somewhere between when the request goes into the system and when it comes out when the reply comes out to the user. That should be fairly obvious. In our case, we're writing to disks, and there can be a pretty big latency in there, so I'll show you that in a minute. But it's necessary to do that with any protocol that has that kind of fault tolerance. The way that Paxos works is it has one node that's designated as leader. The leader stamps operation numbers on and sends them out. The interesting part of Paxos is how to change leaders. I'm not going to talk about that at all. There's many papers that you can read about that. Some of them are even intelligible. So I'm going to show you a picture of how this works. A client makes a request at some operation that it wants to do in the state machine. It sends a message to the leader. The leader then takes the next operation number that it hasn't used and stamps it on that request and sends it out to the other members of the replication group. The members of the replication group now have a copy of a tentative operation, and so they can go off and launch any disk prefetches that they want. Remember I told you with the out-of-order thing that you want to get some parallels, and this is a place to do it. In any case, they launch logging operations. So in this instance, because we're building out of disks, they send the proposal, which is the request plus the operation number, out to the disks. And then you have to wait for those log writes to complete. So in this picture, it happens to complete first on the leader. It could actually complete anywhere. When you've got more than half of the nodes having completed and told the leader about the completion, then it knows that it's committed and that even after a crash or a view change, which is changing leader, it'll be able to find that operation and redo it. So it can tell the state machine, okay, you can go ahead and execute this and return the answer to the client. So it does that by sending a commit message to the other members. That's a small message. And then the state machines are free to execute that operation if they've executed the preceding one. So in this example, I'm going to have the reply come from the leader. So the state machine and leader may be executed first and returns the answer to the client. One thing that's worth noting is if this is writing into memory, the way we've implemented it, there's not a synchronous disk write in the state machine execution. It writes into memory and it gets retired out there later. That's the second half of the model with the out-of-order processor, right? The cache write back, it works almost exactly the same way. Another thing that's worth noting is that unlike primary backup replication systems, all of the replicas are just as good as one another. So if you're concerned about jitter and the performance on the leader, you can send replies from the other members. So in this case, send a couple of extra replies back. And the trade-off there is that maybe the leader was slow because it, you know, the operating system paged it out or something bad happened or it dropped a packet on the network or whatever. And so that'll cover for that in most cases, but you send a few extra small messages on the network. So you can tune this to whatever your application is. Okay, so I'm going to show you a timeline now of those steps. This timeline, it's worth noting, is for one-at-a-time operation. So almost all the time in there is a disk rotational latency at 7,200 RPMs, which takes 8.3 milliseconds. If you look at the tiny little red bar on the left, that's the time to send the proposal out. You can overlap the logging with that on the leader if you want. And even if you were running on something like Flash, the network latencies are still going to be pretty comparable to that. So this protocol isn't going to hurt you even if you're running on a faster thing. It's also worth noting the ETTM talk. They were saying that they were looking at latencies like a millisecond or a half a millisecond to do a Paxos operation. If you log to Flash or you didn't log at all and were willing to accept that the thing goes away if the power goes off, this system would probably produce latencies around 400 microseconds. And we could probably make that faster, but we didn't do anything to tune the network message latency because we knew how big these bars would be and it didn't matter. Anyway, one other thing to take away from this is that there's plenty of time to do that prefetch that I told you about while it's logging. Okay, so now I'm going to move into describing how our system works because you understand Paxos. This is a picture of the architecture. The pieces in blue are just standard Windows code, and the pieces in green are the things that we wrote. So starting from the bottom and working our way up, we wrote a custom log. It's just a log. There's nothing really very interesting about it except that it deals with high bandwidth stuff quickly. We built a custom store also called a stream store. And the way to think of what the stream store does is it's like the bottom half of a file system. It's something like inodes. So you can create and delete these things as much as you want. You can do read, write, truncate, extend. And it does batched atomic commit afterwards. So the state machine writes into memory and then periodically tell the stream store to checkpoint and it will go off and write out all of its data atomically. And of course the RSM can continue running while it's doing that. actually something I hadn't planned on putting in the talk, but again from the ETTM talk. When we ran a load against this system, just creating empty streams, it was just strictly metadata operations, we were able to get about 50,000 metadata operations per second through this system. That number's not in the paper, but since it was apropos of the earlier talk. Anyway, above that is the Gaios RSM. It actually doesn't really do very much other than export something that looks like the stream store. You could imagine building much more complicated services like namespaces or lock managers or pretty much anything you want in there. But for our application, it's building a virtual disk. It's straightforward. Above that is Smarter. And Smarter runs the Paxos protocol, does all the glue, takes care of everything. And on the client, then, we wrote a Windows mode disk driver that takes the streams that are exported by the Gaios RSM and turns them into a virtual disk and exports that up to NTFS. So to Windows, it looks kind of like a RAID system or an external disk array. And then NTFS just runs on it like as a regular volume, and you can run whatever applications you want above that just by reading and writing files. So how do you get efficiency out of a system like this? The first answer is mostly you just apply well-understood engineering techniques. And you pipeline, you batch, you overlap, all of that good stuff that you know to do. If you actually do it, it really helps. I put numbers on the list of things that we did as a sort of very rough guess as to the level of importance, basically because when I did the practice talk, people said I should say that. But the truth is that which optimization is more important depends on a lot on what your load is. If you have a one-at-a-time operation, load coming from the client, pipelining obviously doesn't help because there's nothing to pipeline. But anyway, we did all those things, and then we also built a new protocol for doing read-only operations that I'm going to describe to you in the next section that helps tremendously. So the first question you have to ask is, what properties do you want out of a read on a system like this? And so we have a consistency property here that essentially is just a complicated way of saying that if any write completes in the system, when you do a read after that, you're going to see it. So you're never going to read stale data. So that's the consistency property that we're trying to get. So when you think about read-only operations, they're different from read-write operations in one really fundamental and actually pretty obvious way, which is that you only have to run them in one place. For a read-write operation, obviously it has to happen everywhere because it's going to change the state. You want the state and all the replicas to evolve through the same series of things. But when you're just reading the data, any copy will do as long as you're reading from the right place. When you're running on a disk-based system, if you're doing reads, most likely moving the disk arm is the bandwidth limit in your system. So if you've got multiple disks out there, you really, really want to have all of the disk arms working for you instead of running just one. And so our protocol allows you to use any of the disk arms. excuse me. And it turns out that being able to dynamically select where to send the read can result in a pretty big performance improvement, and I'll show you why. So I told you that the stream store atomically retires a big set of changes at once. And the way that it does that is it's got a big pool of dirty pages, think like an operating system page out daemon. And it launches writes for those pages down into the disk in more or less sorted order because it's trying to give the disk an opportunity to produce a short seek pattern. Furthermore, it's really important to get the writes out there, to get multiple writes in the disk queue at once, because if you ever allow the disk queue to drain, then you're wasting time. So the system will have, you know, in this case, the yellow operations that I put out there are the ones that are currently in the disk queue. So if a read comes in, first of all, the read is most likely not going to be in the range that you're writing, because you have lots of writes to reorder over, so they're probably, the 4 or 10 or whatever they're going to be in the disk queue, are probably pretty dense. And so the read probably won't be there. And because you've already sent this stuff to the disk, there's no way to abort those operations. So the disk is going to sit there and think, well, I want to improve throughput, so I'm going to do it in the shortest seek pattern possible, which is to say I'm going to do all those writes, and then I'm going to do the read. That's really bad, because it means that in order to get this, even if you stop putting new writes in the queue as soon as a read shows up, which is in fact what we do unless we're under terrible memory pressure, it's going to take... You know, you're going to have to complete 5 operations to do one. And so you get really bad performance out of that. By being able to direct reads away from nodes that are writing, if you have a load that doesn't cause you to be writing all the time, you can get substantially improved read performance. Another thing that's necessary to do this is we randomize the times that the checkpoints happen so that all the replicas don't checkpoint in lockstep, because otherwise it wouldn't really help you. Okay, so now I'm going to show you a picture of how the protocol works. First, this is going to look a lot like the previous protocol. Client says a request to the leader. It says, gee, I want to do a read. The leader looks at the highest operation number that it's issued effectively. It's a little, you can read the paper for the real details. It picks the highest operation number that it's issued. It stamps it on that request and says, okay, you can't ever execute before that, because it could be that somebody has seen a write complete up to the maximum number that I've done. But it also needs to assure that no other leader that's been selected after it has gone off and completed new operations. And because we don't use leases to control who's leader, there's no way to do that without doing a network round trip. So it sends a message out to the other members to check leadership, sends them out. They say, yeah, I believe you're still leader. And as long as at least half of the nodes reply, including the leader itself, so two out of three is at least half in this case, then it's able to process the read. In this picture, I have the read come from the leader. You can, in fact, send it anywhere that you want. Reads the data, sends it back to the client. So timeline for this, the green bar is the time to actually do the read. Again, this isn't a rotational latency. This is a seek here. The point to take away from this is the red bar is the time to do the leadership check. And that's the extra overhead that gets added to this protocol that the lease-based primary backup protocols are trying to get rid of. So first observation is it's tiny relative to a disk latency. Second observation is that if you're going to do the read from the leader, you can actually overlap, you can completely overlap that check with the green part. Our system doesn't do that because we knew how big they were relatively and didn't bother, but you could. So if you're reading from flash, for instance, that's probably what you do. Even if you're going to read remotely, you can overlap half of it with the view check, right? Because the leadership's check, the red part, is a round trip, and you could start the read after half of the round trip. So if you remember at the beginning, I said this is useful for systems where the operation latency is comparable or bigger than the network latency, and this is why. If you were running over a wide area where it took you 50 milliseconds round trip to go out and check that you're still leader, you probably don't want to do this. But if you're in a data center, that's not the case unless your network is horribly, horribly messed up. Okay. So now I'm going to go and give you a performance evaluation. I'm going to do a comparison to a very generic form of primary backup. So the literature is absolutely stock full of different primary backup replication schemes. In order to do a comparison, we implemented what amounts to the simplest version that you could imagine, and we implemented it by changing what turned out to be a surprisingly small number of lines in Smarter. These systems are trying to get the same read consistency constraint that we're getting with the read protocol. And they're trying to do it without sending that leadership check round trip. So they do two things to make that happen. First, they have all read and write replies come back from the primary. So in that case, the sequencing is trivial. Because all the writes came from one place, you know that there wasn't some other replica that's ahead of you that's responded to a write, so a client can possibly have seen that write was done ahead of the read. And second, to avoid doing the round trip to check leadership, they use a lease. So the lease says, I promised you that you get to be leader up until a certain time. And so when the primary gets a read request, it can look at the lease and say, well, the lease hasn't expired, so I know that I'm still the primary, and so I'm just gonna immediately launch this request and do it. That, of course, is a compromise that isn't necessarily a great thing, because if you're wrong about whether your lease is expired because your clock is out of sync, then you can get an inconsistency. In real life, that doesn't really happen, because the people who build these systems are smart people, and so they build a large grace period into the lease expiration. So they put, you know, seconds or, you know, even a minute if they're really, really paranoid, of slop into there. And so what they're really doing is that they're not sacrificing correctness, but what they're doing is sacrificing the time to recover from a failed leader. In the Smarter system, we're able to recover from a failed leader in somewhere like 3/4 of a second. It just depends on exactly how we set the timeout, but it's a tiny, tiny amount of time, as opposed to a long time here. So this is, again, a trade-off that you really don't want. So another thing to realize with that scheme is that the primary backup forces all the reads to come from the primary, so it only comes from one node. So the naive version of that is terrible, right? Because if you've got three disks out there in your replication group and you're only moving the arms on one disk, you've thrown away 2/3 of your bandwidth, and that's a horrible waste. So again, the people who build these systems are not that dumb. So they found a way to spread the load out, which is that they don't have just one primary backup group. They have a whole lot of them. And they spray the data around in such a way that there's a primary, at least one primary in every disk. And so if they're able to get random distribution of reads among the group, which they all claim they are, you have to trust them on that. But if they're able to get perfectly balanced distribution, then they'll get a perfectly balanced read node load on those disks, and they'll actually get all of the read bandwidth. However, and there's a big however, the place that they read from is determined statically. It's determined when they put that primary out there. So they can't direct the reads away from the write, and they have that problem of having to deal with the queue, of having to deal with the queued writes that I showed you up with the slide with the yellow picture. So, in any case, in order to compare, we implemented two versions of primary backup. PB1 is the naive version where all of the reads come from one node, and you can imagine what that's going to look like. And then PBN is the best case. It's a bound on how well it can do, which it actually worked just by using the redistribution logic that was in Smarter, and I just assumed that there was a lease that worked. And but it doesn't try to direct reads away, so it round robins them without blindly round robins them. So this is a throughput graph. So unlike the previous timelines that you saw that were one operation at a time, this is putting lots of operations outstanding. And the x-axis is the number of replicas. So the blue line shows Gaius as you increase the number of replicas. And unsurprisingly, the random read throughput grows more or less linearly in the number of replicas. If you look on the number one line on the left-hand side, there's a square there. That's the performance of the local disk. The reason the local disk is faster than Gaius is that the stream store stores checksums of all of its data, and so in order to deal with misbehavior of commodity disks. Remember, so this is commodity parts. And so it's occasionally doing an extra checksum read, and that reduces performance. So the reduction in performance that you see there is unrelated to the replication algorithm. It's related to the paranoia that we built in the system because we wanted it really to work. If you look at the red line, that's PBN, and it scales about the same as Gaios. I can actually explain why the lines don't match, but the important thing is that it does basically the same thing. And the green line shows you that PB1 is a bad idea. So now I'm going to show you one more benchmark. We ran an industry standard online transaction processing load on SQL Server. In a conceivably unrelated note, the Transaction Processing Council does not allow you to use the names of its benchmarks like TPCC unless you jump through a bunch of hoops that I didn't jump through. That may have nothing to do with this talk, but I just thought I'd throw that in. Anyway, what really matters in this benchmark is how quickly you can get SQL log writes out, and that's actually a tiny fraction of the writes, but you need to have low latency on the writes, and then what's the throughput for random reads. And the particular way this is tuned, it's about half reads and half writes coming from SQL Server, and they're usually about 8K because that's SQL Server's page size. It's a little bit bigger than that. But here's the performance graph. These are normalized to running SQL Server on a local node with the same disks that we ran on in the distributed system. So the first thing to notice is that Gaios does a little bit better than the local disk. You might think that it should do a lot better because it's got three times as many arms to do reads from. But there's two things that are going on here. One is it's doing these checksum reads, which actually adds some extra work, but that's necessary for dealing with Byzantine faults. And the more important thing is that while the read write ratio is 50-50 at the client, it's 75-25 writes at the disks because each of the writes are replicated three times, but the reads only go to one place. So you wouldn't actually expect to get triple the read bandwidth out of a system like this. You'd expect to get substantially less. So if you compare it to PBN, it's about 10 or 15% faster than PBN. And the difference there is being able to vector the reads away from the nodes that are writing. There's really no other difference in the system. Now, that's not a huge performance improvement, but remember, the whole idea of relying on clock synchronization for correctness and taking long failure times was to improve performance. And it hurts it. So there's no reason to build that system. You shouldn't do that. And as you might imagine, PB1 is really slow. And that shows you essentially what the overhead you get in the system for adding all of the replication goop, adding the checksums, it's a much, much more complicated system than just a disk. So we imposed some overhead for doing that. Okay, so let me conclude. Paxos replicated state machines are a good idea for a pretty wide range of interesting problems, and you should think hard about whether you want to use them. There's a fair amount of engineering that has to go into building a system like this that performs, but the truth is, if you're trying to solve this problem, you probably have a lot of money on the line, and spending some engineering resources to do good implementation job is not nearly as expensive as the enormous number of disk arrays that you won't be buying. So that's a trade-off that should win every time. It can actually outperform systems that compromise to improve performance. That's upside down, but really beautiful if you're giving this talk. And so you don't need to make these compromises for, again, a wide class of systems. So. Thank you. I'll take questions.
Hi, Steve Hahn, Cambridge. Great talk. I'm curious, though, if you actually did any measurements in the presence of failure?
Yeah, I did. It's in the paper. We induced a fail. But it depends on exactly what you're asking. So the particular measurement that's in the paper is we ran a random read load, a lot like the graph that I showed you in there, and then went and just killed the process on one of the nodes and saw what happened. And what happens is you get a little bit of a one-time glitch while the leader fails over. And then the read bandwidth goes down because now you only have two arms running instead of three. So it does exactly what you'd expect. In general, I didn't run the whole benchmark set against a partially failed system, but it would do about what you would expect, which is to say it would perform a little bit slower because it's got fewer disk arms to do reads.
Okay, thanks.
And the scaling for writes, by the way, is pretty much flat. As you add, I didn't put the graph in the talk, but if you look in the paper, you'll see that as you increase the replication level, the write bandwidth is completely flat. It doesn't depend, which is a nice property to have.
Colin Dixon, University of Washington. I'm the ETTM guy.
Yeah.
And actually, great. This is exactly what I was hoping the talk would be.
Oh, I'm glad you liked it. I liked your talk, too.
I have two questions. The first one is, are the details in the paper about how you do group management and sort of, or do you assume a static set of people participating in the Paxos group?
That actually was in the original SMART paper that Jay Lorch and I and a bunch of other people did. It was in Eurosys like 5 or 6 years ago. So it's referenced in this paper, how to change membership.
Okay, so you do. And then the second question is, can we get the code?
No,
okay, that's
sorry.
That's what I feared the answer was.
Yun Ma from AT&T. So I'm wondering, in a special case where all the states fit into the main memory, does it make your design any difference, or what choice do you make?
So if you're running all the operations out of main memory, then the thing that ends up mattering in the system is the logging latency. And if you were going to build a system like that, you would have to decide, you have three options. Option one is just sort of suck it up that it's going to be a little bit slow to do writes because you've got to write to disk when everything else is in memory. That seems kind of unfortunate. Second one is buy a little bit of flash and log to flash. That's the obvious thing to do. And I'm forgetting what my third idea was. Oh, and the third idea is you may decide that it's okay to run a system that just forgets what's going on if the power goes off, right? So you can treat, Paxos can tolerate fewer than half of the nodes failing. And failing is defined in Paxos as forgetting their state. So ordinarily what that means is a disk crashes so that, you know, the disk is gone and your data isn't there. But if you're willing to count a process crash or a power failure as a Paxos failure, And so you're greatly increasing your probability of losing your application group. Then you don't need to log persistently, and so you can get an operation like that to go very fast. The system as we build it would probably do operations like that, one at a time operations in maybe 400 microseconds, give or take. We didn't tune it for that. I'm sure we could get it faster by trying to make the network path slicker, because 100 microsecond one-way network is not hard to beat if you try, but there was no need to try for our system.
I guess I was going to follow up with that is that if I imagine I want a very fast distributed store and I have a lot of nodes, right, then potentially I could say, look, you know, the chance of my losing power across my entire data center is very small. So would it be sane to think about a very large Paxos group now where each one of them is basically storing almost all the information in memory and then only logging things out to disk when the memory pressure disk dictates?
You could do that. The downside is that all of the operations have to go to all of the nodes, and so you're going to eat up a lot of network bandwidth to do that. But yes, you could build that system if that's a trade-off that works for you. If you had, say, Monsoon and didn't worry about the network bandwidth, then it might work. Anything else? Okay, submit to FAST.